We'll call the House Resources Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:09 p.m. Wednesday, April 7th, 2021. We've developed a quorum with Representative McKay, Representative Fields, Representative Kronk, Vice Chair Hopkins, Representative Rauscher, Representative Hannon, Representative Schragi, I believe Representative Gillum's on the way, and myself, Representative Putkuduk. I'd like to say thank you to our recording secretary, Robin, on the airwaves up there, and our LIO moderator, Alex. Please silence your cell phones and set them up on a notepad so they don't shake across the whole table. I'd like to recognize the staff in the audience to speak on some of the bills that we're going to be hearing today. The first is actually not a bill, but a resolution, SJR 8, and that's the completion of the university land grant by Senator Stevens. And then we've got House Bill 156, and it's the industrial hemp program and manufacturing by Representative Hopkins. So first on the docket, we've got Senate Joint Resolution 8, and we'll start with the introduction and have his staff, Tim, give an introduction to the resolution and himself, and walk us through the presentation. So, Mr. Let me get the pronunciation right. Lamkin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lamkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Unfortunately, Senator Stevens really wanted to be here today for this, and he really appreciates the opportunity that you scheduled the bill. Unfortunately, he was compelled to address some other legislative duties, and so he won't be able to join us. But once again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Alex Rock, if I understand that correctly.
That'll work, too.
So before you is a resolution. I think there's a generally held belief that there's a land deficit held by the University of Alaska. In our current budget climate, this bill or resolution hopes to give the university a renewed opportunity to find some other financial options to manage itself via its potential land holdings and rely less on our state's general fund. So the resolution here is in response to our congressional delegation's request to help them by sending a message to Congress from this body that we want to see a fix for a university and fulfill this grant. The situation's idled for quite some time, and hopefully it brings some resolution to this situation. With that, I think that really the folks that need to be talking here are those that are online, that are our lands experts that represent university, and I'd be happy to introduce them at your pleasure, and we can proceed with the presentation here.
Please do introduce them, Mr. Lampkin.
So I believe we have Mr. Ed Fogels, who is going to speak to this presentation here.
Mr. Fogel, if you can just give us a test and make sure that we can hear you fine, that'd be appreciated. Then put your name on the record and continue.
Sure. Chair Budkatak, members of the committee, good afternoon. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. For the record, my name is Ed Fogels. I have been retained by the university to advise them on land and resource issues, specifically to assist the university in obtaining its unfulfilled land grant entitlement. With me online here, we have Andy Harrington, the chief counsel for the university, and Laura Carmack, who is in their land management office. So these folks will be able to give me a hand if I cannot answer some of your questions. You have a presentation before you. If you'd flip to slide 2 on the presentation. The problem that we're trying to rectify right now is that fundamentally the University of Alaska did not receive its full land grant from the federal government. The university only received about 111,000 acres from the federal government, and this along with other lands that is acquired through private gifts or bequests puts their total land endowment currently at 151,000 acres. The expectation was for more lands to come to the university through various federal acts, which we will kind of touch on briefly here in a few slides. But these federal acts never did materialize this additional land grant entitlement. You would flip to slide 3. with a pie chart. Here you see sort of a breakdown of the university's land holdings. The main bulk of what they currently hold is investment land at 139,000 acres. And you see, can see how it's all broken out into how it's currently being managed by the university's land management office. And notably, you see the pie chart, the gray area on the left, the missing 360,000 acres, which we are trying to acquire. If you would skip to or switch to slide 4, please. This is just a comparison of between the University of Alaska Mental Health Trust and the University of Texas. The University of Texas' land grant totaled 2.1 million acres, and they've generated about $21.4 billion cumulatively as of 2019. The university has, despite its limited endowment, it has still managed to do quite well with its land holdings, has generated about $220 million from these holdings since the 1980s. Go to the next slide. The next three slides kind of give you a bit of an overview of the land grant history. And again, if, we have Andy Harrington here that can provide you more detailed answers should I get lost in some of the legalese here. But essentially, there were three federal acts that started this whole drama. The 1862 Morrill Act should have given the university 90,000 acres. The 1915 Wickersham Act should have given the university another 336,000 acres. Neither of these acts were able to fulfill this entitlement. Essentially, in effect, they were superseded by the Alaska Statehood Act, which gave the state of Alaska a very, very large land entitlement of 103 million acres initially. So at the end of the day, the 1929 Sutherland Act did give the university about 100,000 acres of federal land. So this is essentially constitutes most of what the university has today that they are managing. Go to the next slide. Since statehood, there have been a number of state efforts to try and rectify this and give the university additional lands. Going all the way back to 1959, and then in 2000 again, the Alaska legislature passed a bill to grant the university 260,000 acres. The Supreme Court subsequently ruled after that that it was not an appropriation, but didn't address the dedication clause issue, which I'll talk about in a minute, but that's essentially what killed future state efforts to give the university land. If you go to slide 7, then finally in 2005, the Alaska State Legislature identified specific lands for conveyance to the university and passed legislation to do so. However, this was challenged in court, went all the way to the Alaska Supreme Court, who ruled that the state's giving the land to the university violated the prohibition on no dedicated funds in the Alaska State Constitution. So in 2010, unfortunately, the university had to start conveying these lands back to the state. And so again, at the end of the day, here we are. We're left with 151,000 acres, mostly from the 1929 Sutherland Act. If you go to slide number 8, please. So there's no question in my mind that a larger land endowment would provide financial security for the university in the long term and would certainly help moderate the need for state general fund support for the university. As we've talked about, the state's already tried through the 2005 legislation. This was ruled unconstitutional by the Alaska Supreme Court. So we have to come up with another avenue to accomplish our task here. And it's going to be a combination of a collaboration between the federal government and state of Alaska and the university. If you go to slide number 9, kind of now we get to the specifics of how do we fix this. So the Alaska State Constitution does allow dedicated funds as long as they're required by the federal government for a federal program. So the solution we're trying to undertake here is to collaboratively work with the congressional, the federal Alaska's congressional delegation, the governor's office, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Interior to come up with a way that we would essentially create a federal program through federal legislation. If you go to slide number 10, last year, Alaska's congressional delegation introduced the University of Alaska Fiscal Foundation Act. This would establish a program within the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of Interior to convey this 360,000-acre pool of land directly to the university from the state of Alaska's remaining land entitlement. So just as a quick backgrounder, the state's full land entitlement from the federal government totals 105 million acres. To date, the state has received 100 million of that 105 million acres, so there's 5 million left to go for the state to acquire from the federal government. So this legislation would, in effect, create a mechanism by which, upon concurrence between the state of Alaska and the university, the Department of Interior would shave off 360,000 acres of this 5 million and direct it to the university instead of directing it to the Department of Natural Resources for management as general state land. So that is, in effect, the current legislation. That it was introduced last year, but unfortunately it was not able to advance last year. So the congressional delegation is working right now to reintroduce it in this 117th Congress. So we're hopeful that will happen here very quickly, and then we can implement this program. So members of the committee, that is a very fast and high level overview of what we're trying to accomplish for the university. Again, there's no question that a larger land endowment for the university would make it a much stronger university system top to bottom, and I encourage your support of this resolution and this effort, and I will now be prepared to answer questions or work with Andy or Laura to answer any of your.
Thank you, Mr. Fogle, for the presentation. And before we entertain questions, let the record reflect that Representative Gillum has joined us at 1:18 p.m. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'll just first and foremost say I am a former student regent, and the issues of the land selection through the university has been there since its founding, and certainly in the early 80s, the issue was there. My first question is about Mr. Fogle. You said you were retained by the university.
Can we just make sure that he's online and hearing the question, Representative Hannon? Sorry. Mr. Fogle, can you verify that you're there?
Yeah, well, we'll just hang tight and see if it clears up here. But
Mr. Fogle, we can hear you now.
Now I'm still pretty frozen. Hopefully I...
Can you hear us, Mr. Fogles? Is our presentation, it says Grace is muted, is that?
I'm barely able to hear you, Mr. Chairman.
Can you hear me now? What's that? We'll take a brief at ease. Back from our brief at ease. Mr. Fogles, can you verify that we can hear you, you can hear us, et cetera?
Yes, I can hear you, members of the committee. Hopefully you can hear me now, too.
Yes, we can. We'll resume where we were with Representative Hannon's question.
Thank you. Through the chair. So, Mr. Fogle, you opened with you were retained by the university. So can you just describe for me a little bit, are you retained by the university to walk this all the way through the congressional process and do land selections itself? Or are you an Alaska-based, or are you a D.C. guy who's going to help us find the land for the university endowment?
Yes, Representative Hannon. No, I'm based in Alaska, and my role is to help identify the 360,000 acres of land that the university should acquire. Staff in D.C. that are doing the legwork of the congressional delegation. So that's their primary role. My primary role is here in Alaska to look at the different lands that are available and recommendations to the university for what they should.
And follow up.
Representative Hannon, Mr. Fogles, I don't know if you're plugged into a headset or something like that, but you're coming in real scratchy. If there's any way that maybe you can take us straight to your phone, or maybe the cell service is bad where you're at, but just want to let you know. Representative Hannon.
Chair, I'm hearing that scratchiness too. I'm just using my regular landline, so it's hardwired in. I could try and dial in again if that might help.
No, we just heard you make that statement loud and clear, so if you can maintain that quality, I think our question and answers will be fine. Representative Hannon, follow up.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Fogle, as you laid out in the problem statement and through it, at one point the federal government has postured that they don't have to give us any more land, us the university, because they already gave it to us the state. But it does look like what we are seeking this time is specific allocations of land out of federal lands. Can you tell me if I am perceiving that correctly, that we are looking for 360,000 acres of land that the federal government currently holds title to in Alaska versus state allocations to come?
Right. Representative Hannon, through the chair, you're correct. The 360,000 acres we are looking to acquire would be federal land. The difference is that this is federal land that's already been tagged by the state of Alaska for potential transfer to the state. So it's got a legal kind of a framework on it. It's state-selected land. So and we're not able to select, say, federal lands that are outside of that state-selected pool. So from the federal government side, they're giving the state of Alaska another 5 million acres. So they're still only going to give the state of Alaska in some 5 million acres, except that 360 of that would be diverted then to the university.
Okay. And then one more follow-up, which is, so the issue of this, the land allocation has always been, in the end, we still have several local governments across the state that have either not received their full land entitlement and transfer, or have yet to form a first-class borough or a first-class city to be able to do land selections. And so I want to know if we have, if local governments who have a land entitlement obligations, or the state still has land entitlement obligations to, have been involved with the process to DNR. Because, of course, the thing we as legislators are we have to balance is making sure that we're not endowing one group while we're taking from another. And the conflict is always about what that value of an acre of land is, and it's always about where that acre is in conjunction to my local government or my profitability. And, you know, I presume that the state's not really interested in giving up any of its land holdings in oil lease areas, and so we're looking at timbered land or lands closer to municipalities that might have real estate value. Do you know where local government allocations are in relation to this land selection process?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, at this point, I would have to say that I don't. I know that most of the municipalities are are not all of them, but most of them are nearing the completion of the municipal entitlements, but as you point out, some are not. The way this process would work, however, is that what we're doing is we are identifying potential lands that we would like to see the university acquire. Those lands, we then are submitting those lands to the Department of Natural Resources for review, and they will have to do some kind of best interest finding on this package, and they would be doing a public notice. They would be then looking at the particular lands we've identified, and then they would identify any conflicts or encumbrances that may be on that land. For example, if it's already being sought after by a municipality, they would let us know that, and then, you know, we may very well just decide that that's land that we will not ask for. But so there's a lot of process still to be undertaken as we go through this endeavor, and it will involve a scrubbing by the Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Chairman. The representative from Juneau has pretty much answered or asked the questions that I had, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Any other committee members have questions for Mr. Fogles or Mr. Lampkin? Seeing or hearing none, we'll move on to public testimony now. Thank you for being available, Mr. Fogles, and bearing with us through our technical difficulties. You ready to go into public testimony there, Alex? Okay. Public testimony on Senate Joint Resolution 8 is now open. I believe we only have one person on the queue. We'll give you 3 minutes, Tom Bryce. The floor is yours. Please introduce yourself, your affiliation and residency, and continue with your public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Tom Bryce. I'm a resident of Juneau. I'm also a UAF grad, class of 90, and I'm on the UAF Alumni Association Board of Directors. And I'd like to thank you for hearing this bill, and also Senator Stevens for carrying it, and Mr. Lampkin for all of his work that he's done to move this issue along. Just very briefly, I'd like to express our support, my support, as well as the Board of Directors' support for this, for SJRA. You should find a letter of support from the board in your bill packet. The university, obviously, as well as most all the other state agencies, are facing some difficult times financially. You guys are very well aware of that. Being able to diversify the funding sources for the university is important, I think, to long-term health and growth. And that ultimately comes back to growth in our economy and stability in our economy. Providing these additional acres, are advocating for the federal government to provide the additional acres to the university, I think, is a wonderful step to actually providing some long-term stability. I'll leave it at that. I know you guys are busy. Just thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this, and I encourage you to move it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Bryce, for your public testimony. Alex, can you verify there's no one else on public testimony for us?
Mr. Chairman, for hearing this, I encourage you to move.
Former Representative Mr. Hi. Bryce. I'm sure you're familiar with the cumbersome process that it is, and I want to thank you for your appreciation in at least slating a hearing on this in this committee. With that, we'll close public testimony. Plan is to bring Senate Joint Resolution 8 back up next week, and we'll set a amendment deadline and make sure that the committee members are aware of that. I'd like to thank Mr. Lampkin for making this as quick as an easy hearing as possible and being available for any questions. If you'd like to say anything before we move on to the next piece of legislation, you're more than welcome to. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The nodding of the head no is reflected on the record. We'll now move to House Bill 156, which is Representative Hopkins' bill, and he's got his staff here, Mr. Hardenbrook, to walk us through what this bill does. Representative Hopkins, I'll give you the floor before Mr. Hardenbrook carries through the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the...
Hot mic.
Thank you. Thank you. All right.
Controversy from the...
It's a rough bill. No, sir, this is, in fact, a simple bill. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am apparently...
Want to take a brief of these?
Yeah. Sure. Testing. I guess that's a little better. Yeah. All right.
Testing on the other mic? Yep.
Right. Is that one good?
Okay. Yeah.
Go back on the record, though. Good. We're back to order now. We'll give Representative Hopkins the opportunity to introduce this bill. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll give it another shot. Members of the committee, thank you. For the record, Representative Hopkins, House District 4, North Fairbanks, Esther, Goldstream, Farmers Loop, Birch Hill and Steel Creek and downtown Fox. Today I'm here to present on House Bill 156 to the Resources Committee. I'm proud to be working with my colleague, Senator Shelley Hughes from the other body, to advance this important and pressing legislation. As my staff will elaborate later, there are federal timelines which require action by the Alaska State Legislature this year in order to keep our fledgling industrial hemp industry alive, progressing, and in compliance with federal law. Today, Alaskan farmers are growing industrial hemp for animal feed, nutraceuticals, which are nutritional supplements, manufacturing, and other uses. Farmers in Alaska have been growing hemp for several years since our pilot project went into place. I would note for the committee that industrial hemp, as governed by federal law, is a different industry entirely than Alaska's state-licensed recreational marijuana program. In 2018, the 30th Alaska Legislature saw the unanimous passage of Senate Bill 6, which established a pilot industrial hemp program in Alaska. With the passage, then, of the federal 2018 Farm Bill, the United States Congress changed federal requirements for state industrial hemp programs. House Bill 156 will empower the Alaska Division of Agriculture to work constructively with Alaskan farmers, both small and large scale, and the federal government to create a new industrial hemp program compliant with federal guidelines. It is my hope that these changes will result in the continued development of a new and thriving industry for Alaska's farmers and manufacturers, diversify our economy, and increase state revenues. Chair Pakatuk, with the committee's permission, I'd ask Joe Hardenbrook, my trusty staff, to walk the committee through the bill packet.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. Mr. Hardenbrook, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 156 to the Resources Committee today. With us online today for questions are Dave Sade and Robert Carter from the Division of Agriculture and Joan Wilson from the Department of Law. Industrial hemp is a variety of the cannabis...
Mr. Hardenbrook, can you put your name on the record,
please? Sorry, Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, Joe Hardenbrook, staff to Representative Hopkins. Industrial hemp is a variety of the cannabis sativa plant grown specifically for industrial use. While both marijuana and industrial hemp are derived from the same species, they are distinct strains with different and unique chemical compositions and uses. The example I usually use is that broccoli, cauliflower, and Brussels sprouts are all the same genus and species of plants, just the different varieties result in different properties for those plants. Hemp has been grown as a crop for millennia and was one of the first agricultural crops to be spun into fiber for making rope and textiles. Along with bamboo, hemp is one of the fastest growing plants on the planet Earth, making it of particular interest to northern farmers dealing with long growing days and short growing seasons. Hemp can be processed into a variety of commercial items, including paper, rope, nutritional supplements, clothing, plastics, paint, insulation, concrete, biofuel, medications, and animal feed. Increasingly, hemp is made into food for human consumption, including dairy substitutes, oils, granolas, and snack bars. Hemp seeds are high in iron and protein and can be ground into meal or processed into oil. The U.S. Agricultural Act of 2014 allowed states to create hemp farming pilot programs overseen by state agencies or institutions of higher education. To date, 47 states have enacted legislation allowing for hemp cultivation. In 2018, Senate Bill 6 passed the legislature unanimously, establishing an industrial hemp pilot program for the state of Alaska. Later that year, the U.S. Congress passed the 2018 Farm Bill, which removed hemp from the Schedule I list of drugs and made it an agricultural commodity, enabling hemp farmers to receive licenses, loans, and federal crop insurance. The terms of the 2018 Farm Bill required state programs to comply with the new federal guidelines by the end of October 2020. This deadline was pushed back to October of 2021 due to the pandemic. Mr. Chairman, I would point out that this is why this legislation has a sense of urgency. Without passage and approval of a federally compliant hemp program this session, Alaskan farmers who have invested their time, resources, and available land in this new industry could face an uncertain future. This bill would empower the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources to create an industrial hemp program in line with the federal requirements. The Commissioner would include manufacturing and sales of products made from hemp, along with necessary registration and renewal procedures in the regulations for the program. To comply with federal requirements, the bill prohibits those convicted of a felony involving controlled substances within the last 10 years from applying for a hemp growing license. To qualify as industrial hemp, the THC, or delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol level of the crop must be below 0.3% of the dried weight of the plant. Hemp has a higher concentration of cannabidiol, or CBD, which decreases or eliminates the psychoactive effects of THC. As we're talking about a plant here, natural variations in seed stock and growing conditions can result in a crop with a concentration above the legal limit of 0.3% THC. Under current law, the commissioner must issue a stop order and report a grower to the Department of Public Safety and the Marijuana Control Board if a crop tests above the 0.3% limit. This legislation would allow the commissioner to work with a grower to recondition a crop that comes in above the legal limit for THC, provided the crop is between the 0.3% limit and the total 1% THC concentration. Tested crops which exceed the 1% limit must still be destroyed. A grower who refuses to comply with regulations could and most likely would be sanctioned by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. There's a bit of a complicated legislative two-step at the end of this bill. Basically, the final sections of the bill would strike the existing industrial hemp pilot program from state statute once the approval of Alaska's new industrial hemp program by the United States Department of Agriculture becomes effective. The bill carries a fiscal note of roughly $750,000 annually. Alaska Statute 0305010 requires that the industrial hemp program be self-sustaining through fees and revenue from the industry. So all costs will be covered by program receipts generated by program participants. Should the program flourish and grow, all additional costs associated with the program will continue to be raised through fees and licenses. As the administration states in their fiscal note, the industrial hemp program has the potential to have participants in nearly every town and village across Alaska, which will be a significant workload increase for the division. It is projected that 2,000 to 3,000 applications would be processed and monitored on a yearly basis. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would just echo the words of the bill sponsor. There's a federal deadline in the 2018 Farm Bill, which makes passage of this legislation during this session critical. Alaska farmers and their families have invested their time and resources into this new industry, and House Bill 156 will bring our laws into alignment with the federal requirements, protect the investments of Alaska's hemp farmers, and open our economy to new opportunities. Mr. Chairman, if it's all right with you, I would go through a quick sectional analysis of House Bill 156.
Yeah, unless any committee members have any questions, we'll continue with that. Mr. Hardenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 1 includes two subsections, authorizing the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources to include manufacturing and retail sales of products made from industrial hemp, as well as registration and renewal procedures in the regulations for the new industrial hemp program. Section 2, I mentioned earlier, gives the DNR Commissioner the ability to work constructively with a grower if their crop tests above the 0.3% legal THC limit, but below the 1% THC limit. And just for the information of the committee, most recreational marijuana sold in Alaska has a concentration of about 15 to 20% THC, so that would be 600 times as potent as the hemp that we're discussing here in this legislation. Section 3 adds language that a registrant for the industrial hemp program is not eligible if they have been convicted of a felony involving a controlled substance within the past 10 years. And this section was added to comply with provisions of the federal 2018 Farm Bill. Section 4 adds that the department may develop an industrial hemp program to comply with federal requirements and submit the plan to the USDA for approval. Section 5 again states that a grower may retain and recondition their crop if it tests above the 0.3 limit but below the 1% limit. Section 6 is the new subsection that adds that a person who retains but fails to recondition a crop is guilty of a violation. Section 7 changes the statutory definition of hemp to match the federal definition. And then sections 8, 9, and 10 deal with the effective date for repealing the hemp pilot program and instating the hopefully to be approved USDA-approved Alaska industrial hemp program that would be developed by the commissioner under this legislation. Mr. Thank Chairman, you. That concludes my rundown of the sectional analysis and a quick overview of the bill, and I'm happy to take questions from the committee.
Okay, before we dive into a little bit, maybe a little more discussion on the fiscal notes, committee members have questions that so far we can ask them now. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. So just out of curiosity, under Section 5, what would it mean to recondition a crop? So we've added language that they can retain that crop, but what does reconditioning mean? Can you walk me through that?
Representative Shragi, through the chair. My understanding is that this would allow farmers who might have a crop that is above the THC limit to work with another farmer whose crop is below so that they can intermingle those crops and wind up with a total amount of hemp which is below the legal limit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hardenbrook.
That was my question.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. Any other questions from committee members? Maybe just a point of interest for me on Section 2, you talk about the what Representative Shragi mentioned as far as conditioning it to get below that 0.3% THC level. In the pilot program, do we have any examples of the commissioner exercising his authority maybe to issue citations or potentially work with growers that may have inadvertently gone over the concentration limit?
Mr. Chairman, I do not have evidence or an example of the commissioner doing that specific item. The reason why this was included in the bill was because current law states that if your crop is above the 0.3%, that the commissioner shall cite you as being in violation. Mm-hmm. This provision would allow the commissioner, if a grower or a farmer is acting in good faith and working cooperatively with the commissioner, for them to recondition their crop and sell it as opposed to a mandatory violation and reporting to the Department of Public Safety and the Marijuana Control Board.
Thank you. And that's what I wanted to highlight was the effort of folks in the industry, as long as they're acting in good faith, respectively, we're not going to swing the hammer down on them no matter what. So I appreciate that aspect of the bill. Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a hemp bill, so I have a few questions here. There's mention of, the first page there, 7 through 9, dairy cattle raising for farming, grain production, and then I go to the next page, and it gets, there's still that involved, and then there's regulate the farming of elk. So I'm like, I got no problem if we have a hemp bill, but I'm not sure why this language is interjected into this bill.
Representative Kronk, through the chair, it is a legislative drafting style. If you read line 3 on page 1, that section is amended to read, and then it has everything in it, and the only new language being added into that section are E and F, and that's the appropriate place in statute based on legislative drafting.
Thank you.
And to clarify, those changes are on page 2 and 3.
Yes, thank you, Mr.
Nothing
Chair.
Changed on page 1 and yep. majority of page 2.
Correct.
Any other questions from committee members? Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, are we going to have a presentation from Mr. Sade, the director of Ag?
We have not requested, Representative Hannon, through the chair. We have not currently requested one, but when the bill comes back up before committee, if the chairman is amenable, we could certainly explore that.
Representative, I was when we had the I guess pre-meeting on this, that was kind of what we were talking about, but we also didn't want to slow down the bill to learn about the industry. But I similar interest I had was learning about the industries.
Yeah, thank you. Very supportive. Kind of stunned that we struggled with this in the 31st legislature to make sure that we were moving forward with a program that had been passed, but then there was a destruction of a crop and a year and a loss. So I think one of the things that would be helpful to know is how have our test programs gone? And again, I don't want to slow the bill down because we want to comply because we know that we're going to be successful in this industry in that we are, you know, it is one of the crops that could grow outdoors in parts of Alaska where we don't have a lot of commercial agricultural potential. And so I am curious in the test pilot, I guess it's pilot projects that they've been called, what their THC levels have been and, you know, Mr. Sade's conclusion to that. And I, you know, this should be a moneymaker for Alaska, and we should be able to put a lot of raw acreage into production.
And Representative Hannon, I think that dovetails us into the kind of the details of the fiscal note, and if we can have some discussion around that, and I'll give Mr. Hardenbrook the floor to take us through that, and if Mr. Sade has anything he wants to add, I think that'll be helpful for all committee members. So,
and if Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, we could pose a question to Mr. Sade, who's on the line right now, and see if he has some updates for the committee on how the pilot program has been implemented.
Absolutely, Mr. Sade, can you hear us?
Mr. Chairman, this is Dave Shady, Director of the Division of Agriculture.
We stand corrected, Mr. Shady. The floor is yours.
So, yes, we've had a successful growing season. Things have gone well. So I'm going to turn this over to Rob Carter, the state agronomist, who has managed these tests, and he can give you a quick rundown of the acreage, indoor and outdoor, and the testing that we've done. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Shady. Mr. Carter.
For the record, this is Rob Carter, the state agronomist at the Division of Agriculture. Thank you all for the opportunity. A quick rundown on the 2020 growing year. As we all know, it was a little bit of a difficult one. We had 70 registered acres around the state of Alaska, 9,000 indoor square feet or controlled environment, high tunnels and hoop houses, a few greenhouses as our first year of our trial product. To answer your questions, we had no grower test over above the 0.3. In fact, we actually had no variety of industrial hemp produced by any grower in the state or by our pilot program produce over 0.2%, so much lower than even the legal limit. We have included it at our Division of Ag Plant Material Center. We've tested about 25 varieties of industrial hemp, both indoor and outdoor, and yet to have any of those test above the 0.3%, even in our trials, pushing them to all limits possible to validate that they are truly hemp. We still can only get to 0.25, and that was just actually a recent indoor test that that concluded here about a month ago. All in all, for the 2021 season, we're looking at currently and still having applications being processed. We have 11 growers, and it looks like it's going to be somewhere around 200 acres. So we've seen, you know, more than 100% increase. If there's other specific questions, I'd be more than happy to answer those for you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. And maybe all I would ask is that if we can have, you know, just a one-page table kind of outlining last year's performance of the industry just to be distributed to the committee members. I think that would be helpful. I see a lot of folks writing those numbers down as I was. So follow-up, Representative Hannon, if you have.
Thank you. Mr. Carpenter, through the chair, 2 years ago you presented to a couple committees and we talked about the potential for especially a CBD oil production that we were speculating would be very high in Alaska. Were you, is that part of the pilot testing, or is your testing and results that growers have to share with you strictly the THC testing amount, and they get to keep the proprietary info about what they think their individual crop might be good for?
For the record, this is Rob Carter, Division of Ag. To answer your question, we do both. This industry is very open with their process and their business. Legally, we do sample and test for THC concentration to validate that it is truly industrial hemp and not recreational cannabis. Of our growers in 2020, all growers shared with us a multitude of what their uses were. We saw it go from feed and fiber and biomass production, from everything from tentative bioplastics to pelletized fuel, and then of course floral production and harvest to be used for other types of wellness products such as CBD, CBG, and CBA that you see out and available on the market. All of those tests, some were proprietary, and they kept that those numbers to themselves that were non-tetrahydrocannabinol based. But from our tests and the amount of varieties that we grew under our trials, they all showed great promise for the results. And I will tell you that we currently have we're pushing about 200 registrants in the program. We have about four processors that take raw industrial hemp and turn it to another form. We have about three or four more coming online this season. And really, it's just the this program is in its infancy. We're seeing the interest, we're seeing the production, we're seeing the trialing, and I think we'll see the post-harvest processing develop over the next 12 to 16 months.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Chair. I was just wondering, the indoor versus outdoor, is the season very, very short in Alaska? Is it long enough to make it worth its time? Is the indoor more profitable than the outside? And I was just wondering, where is the market? Is it in Alaska? Do we manufacture here? Or is it export? And is it out of country? Or is it in country? Sorry for piling all that up at once.
For the record, this is Rob Carter, Representative Rauscher. I will try to get all of your questions. If I miss one, please just spear me and I'll answer it for you. Indoor production is just a different methodology than outdoor production. Industrial hemp for fiber and biomass is generally done very similar on large acreage to giant barley, or even looks more like, you know, the same planting tactics as corn. Those are grown outside. They're vegetative. There are some types or varieties of industrial hemp that do flower in our long daylight outside. It's a different planting technique, more looks like a Christmas tree farm. That's generally for oil extraction, and then of course the biomass is used again for everything from poultry bedding to the addition to abrasives in human products, soaps and salves and lotions. The indoor production was very focused on the floral production of the industrial hemp for those cannabinoid wellness products. I would say, I think I might have missed some of your questions, so you're going to have to refresh me, sir.
I believe import and export in the industry.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, sir. Yes, we're seeing a significant market here in state for industrial hemp and their derivatives. Majority of them are shipped in from other states at this point because our production hasn't caught up with the national average at this point. We are for sure evaluating some of the in-state bioplastic development here. That's large-scale production, large-scale development. The potential of this is to be sold in-state, used in-state, and of course with everyone knowing that Alaska is clean, our water's clean, our soils are clean, and we have isolation distance from all other large agriculture around the community, the international interest in our hemp products is actually is moving along very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Follow-up, Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. And basically, is manufacturing catching up to the agricultural end of it? In the state.
for the record, this is Rob Carter, through the chair, Representative Roucher. This season, we've seen it. Last year was a difficult year for everyone. A lot of our interested producers in industrial hemp did what they do, and they produced food because they just knew the situation that we were currently going through. This year, yes, we're seeing a lot more interest in the processing side and developing those in-state. I think that we'll always build to grow more plant material that we can process, but I think that we're evaluating current industrial applications where we have processing facilities in the state already developed that can utilize the industrial hemp after it's produced as well. So we have kind of a window of time as the industrial hemp specific processors develop their methodology and their products.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Roucher and Mr. Carter. Representative Gillum.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for my own knowledge, how is it you control the THC percentage in the crops? And also, and who does the testing?
Mr. Chairman, I think we'd punt that to Mr. Carter at DNR.
Mr. Carter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Rob Carter. Through the chair, we actually do all the sampling for grown industrial hemp in the state for chain of custody reasons, for the newness of this crop, for having other like species in the state being grown by another agency and highly regulated. The division itself pulls the samples. We test the samples in-house, so we maintain that chain of custody. The grown material cannot leave the farm but can be harvested until we get those test results back and provide them to the grower.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Follow-up, Representative Gillum.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I know the recreational part is very highly regulated, even to, from what I understand, they have serial numbers on the seeds. Are you guys, are you under that kind of restriction, or how does that work?
For the record, this is Rob Carter through the chair, Representative. No, with the 2014 and 2018 Farm Bill, identifying industrial hemp as another agricultural commodity. It's really the genetics of this plant and this seed that keep its THC concentration lower than the legal limit and much, much lower than the recreational side of cannabis. But really the definitive is the THC test anywhere between, you know, 7 and 14 days before harvest. And that is why we retained the sample collection and the testing in-house in-state so that we can validate that and then provide direction so that it either will move into market or get distorted or reconditioned to make sure that we don't get deviation of a higher THC concentration industrial hemp plant back out into the market.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carter, and thank you, Representative Gillum. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Kronk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where would you expect the best places in the state for this to be grown outside?
For the record, this is Rob Carter. Through the chair, Representative, I will tell you that we've had last year in 2020, we had producers on the Kenai Peninsula here in South Central, I guess Mat-Su, and upwards north of Talkeetna, Trappers Creek, and just south of the Alaska Range. This year we have producers scattered all over the state from Delta to North Pole to Fairbanks to Homer. We have some interest in some folks actually growing stuff in Southeast and some small production, small acreage, high production lands there. I would tell you that from a biomass perspective, I would see the greatest potential for production to be just north of the range in the North Pole Delta area. I would see some very specific, small, high-dollar, high-value, high-intensity crops could be produced anywhere in the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
So that means trees and no hemp, not in barrel. But anyway, continuing on with the committee questions, any others from committee members? Seeing or hearing none, thank you, Mr. Carter and Shady. Sorry for the mispronunciation as I had it written down. And it, maybe just for my own little interest, what kind of dollar amounts were associated with the pilot program as far as revenues, what the industry is looking like, and stuff like that? And that'll probably be my last question.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Joe Hardenbrook from the Office of Representative Greer Hopkins. Looking at the fiscal note, the state is anticipating revenue of $750,000 annually from this program. That is new state revenues brought into the state coffers because of this industrial hub program. If we see the continued growth of the program like DNR is talking about, then that number could grow.
And that's a number that's based on previous performance with the pilot program performance years?
The revenue, yes. The program participation in grow operations and retail applications are expected to increase significantly with an estimated increase in revenue of $750,000 annually.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hardenbrook, though, this is the revenue to run the program, correct?
No, Representative Hannon, through the chair, there will be the cost of the program will be covered through program receipts.
Right.
Additionally, the program will bring into the state, if you look on change in revenues on the first page of the fiscal note, general fund UGF increase of $750,000 annually.
Follow-up, Representative Hannah.
How is that structured? Is there a specific tax on the hemp, or is it, if you are not an S corporation, how have we structured to gain revenue off of this?
And I think I would punt that to Mr. Shady at the Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Shady.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Dave Shady, Director of the Division of Ag. So in the first year, we're close to about $200,000 in receipts. So as part of our pilot program, we have a registration set of criteria, first for growers, second for manufacturers, and third for retail. So as the representative's office said, you know, where there's 2,000 to 3,000 retailers in the state, we've only got 200 registered. So as we've started to grow this up, then we started hiring our people. So we've only had enough income to hire one of our two people. And so as this program builds, we will continue to grow. So yeah, the challenge we have is, one, getting the funds so that we can hire the people as we go up. Our estimates is this program, working between manufacturers, growers. The growers, actually a small amount of fees. The majority of the fees are come from the retailers. We expect between $1 million and $1.2 million when this is a fully mature program. So as I told the legislators last year, we hire as we have the funds and as the program grows, but the potential is that we expect to be about $1 million in revenue, and it'll take these so there's five additional people to the two that we already have approved for the permanent program. And over time, as this goes up, then we will have the receipts. One of my challenges is we do not have the authority to keep receipts between one year to the next. And so since most of our fees are coming in December, January, we've been working with OMB to try to make sure we can bridge and have funding for our staffing the full year.
Do you have a follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Hannon.
Mr. Shady, do we have any specific – so I understand the receipts and know that it's a self-funded program, and as a pilot program, we had limited number of growers who were able to access it, and it's to pay for the oversight of it. Do we have currently in statute any specific taxes or revenue that is required to be shared? So let's just say I'm successful as a grower, and I'm going to do bioplastics, and a large soda company decides they're going to make bioplastic bottles with our hemp from Alaska, and I now go from being a grower in Toke, Alaska, to being the manufacturer for, you know, a multi-million-dollar corporation. Do we have any taxes specific to the industry, or is it simply taxes all other businesses and the revenue receipts is to cover the administration of the program?
The latter, ma'am. There are no specific taxes for industrial hemp. It is another agricultural product, which is the difference between the recreational side, which does. So
right.
You are absolutely correct, Representative Hannon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hannon and Mr. Shady. I believe we had Representative Gillum and Representative Crump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you answered my question. I know the recreational side is not allowed to use banks, so they're basically a cash business. And I was just curious, are you guys kind of stuck in that same situation, or can you actually use a banking system?
Representative, through the chair, this is Dave Shady again. Legally, industrial hemp is allowed to use banking. We are our industry is finding challenges because some of the banking institutions, cannabis is cannabis, and they don't like dealing with the paperwork. So that is something that we've been, as a division, working with our banking industry to try help them educate them that it's an industrial crop. And as the industry grows and the revenues are there, I think that problem will be solved. There are out-of-state banks that do banking for industrial hemp companies, so it's not like they don't have options. It's just a challenge, unlike under federal law and our recreational cannabis side, it's illegal to do banking.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shady and Representative Gillum. Representative Crunk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a question for Mr. Carter. I'm relating to outside growing. Has there been any issues with wildlife damaging the crop? And I'm specifically interested in Delta. If we, you know, let's say it's really successful, you know, we got that Delta bison herd there, and I know the issues it creates with, you know, growing there. So I was just kind of wondering if do moose love it? Do you know, are we gonna have, you know, is that gonna be an issue?
For the record, this is Rob Carter, through the chair, Representative Kronk. Actually, in 2020 and in through the actual producer produce industrial hemp lots around the state, we saw no predation from any animal. Not saying that a herd of bison couldn't do some serious damage on some 9-foot tall industrial hemp if it was a solid stand planting over a couple thousand acres.
Follow-up, Representative Kronk.
Thank you. And so how fast do these plants grow? I mean, if you plant them in the spring, are they being harvested in the fall?
Through the chair, Representative, for the record, this is Rob Carter. Yes, we're seeing plants transplanted on a traditional year somewhere around Memorial Day, direct seeded as early as May 10th and as late as June 1, and harvest being completed by about the 20th of September.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kronk and Mr. Carter. Any other questions from committee members? Seeing or hearing none, I believe we're ready to go into public testimony. Is there anything else the representative would like to say before we do that?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the good questions, and look forward to public testimony and moving it forward at the next committee as fast as we can, and we'll make sure the department's here with a little bit of presentation if the committee still would like it at the next one.
Okay, appreciate that. And I think just on the general discussion, right, we have the understanding that we need to get this bill through before the sunset, but I think just garnering the interest that it has, perhaps at some point, maybe in the interim, we'll dive into the industry as a whole, just so we can be apprised of it. With that, Alex, are you ready to move into public testimony? Public testimony on HB 156 is now open. I'd like to ask those testifying, please keep their testimony to 3 minutes, and it looks like there's only one person on the queue for public testimony. So, Ember Haynes, if you can please put your name on the record, your affiliation, residency, and continue with your public testimony. The floor is yours.
Greetings, committee members and chair. My name is Ember Haynes from Talkeetna. Thank you for hearing my testimony in favor of HB 156 and an ag hemp industry in Alaska. I'm a business owner and licensed hemp grower up here in Talkeetna. My husband and I have been actively advocating for a legal hemp industry since 2014 and formed our second business, Denali Hemp Company, as a modality of hemp education and a chance to introduce our customer base to the many uses and many reasons for hemp. We are currently in our second year as growers in Alaska's program, adding hemp to our sustainable lifestyle and small-scale production. We represent the small-scale grower, building the industry through grassroots education and promotion, providing the base for an industry that can create so many items and benefits. There are many small acreage growers around the state who would like the chance to produce hemp on their land and contribute to the forming of a viable agricultural hemp industry in Alaska. It is encouraging to see more Alaskans wanting to get involved and open to the possibilities. I do regret that longtime Alaska hemp advocate Frank Cherney of Fairbanks is no longer with us. I know how ecstatic he would be to see hemp finally growing in Alaska and for HB 156 to be sponsored by Representative Hopkins. It is so fitting and an honor to all of Frank's hard work over the years. I just want to thank you for your support of this bill and Alaska's budding hemp industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes, for your public testimony. And Alex, can you please clarify that there's nobody else on the queue? Thank you. With that, we will close public testimony on HB 156. The plan is to bring both SJR 8, as mentioned before, and HB 156 back up next week. Grace will be in touch with your offices to communicate amendment deadlines. And then at that point, I think we'll be ready to move both out of committee. If there's anything you'd like to say, concluding public testimony, Representative Hopkins, you may.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the support and the questions from the members of the committee. There are, as the public testimony person said, a number of people already growing and looking forward to making sure that this program stays in compliance with federal law and federal regulations is going to be key to making sure that we don't lose this industry just as it's getting off the ground. So thank you very much for understanding the time frame and for the questions.
All righty. Okay, with that, just want to let folks know and be reminded that on Friday we'll be considering amendments to House Bill 26, which is the Conflict of Interest Board of Games and Fisheries that we previously heard in this committee. And then, something special for everybody, we get a Saturday at 1 p.m. Appointments meeting with the House Fisheries Committee. So I look forward to seeing you all this weekend. And I know how excited everyone is for that. And if you can please reach out to Grace and let us know if you would unfortunately not be able to make the Saturday meeting, that'd be much appreciated to have that notice. With that, we've got a whole nother 40 minutes if anybody would like to say anything. Seeing or hearing none, we'll call this meeting adjourned at 2:20.